the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, draws were the order of the day in a lot of games in J1 Match Day 30 over the weekend. But we did have a couple of crunch six-pointers down in the dogfight. They certainly did not disappoint.
No, they didn't. Actually, massive victories for the two home teams in that game. Two really exciting games. A bit of controversy, especially in the Vissel Gamba game that we'll get onto. But yeah, all in all, yeah, it's just shuffled the deck around a little bit at the bottom, but still no idea who's staying up or going down.
Most definitely. And yes, we thought we might have been sounding the death knell for the J1 title race after a Kawasaki second draw of the week on Saturday night opened the door for Yokohama F. Marinos to potentially shut it on the rest of their competition on Sunday at home against Sapporo. But yeah, strangely, a sentence I'd never thought I'd utter. The Sapporo defense stood tall and for the good of the J1 title race, kept out the top flight leaders. So once again, for the second straight week, we will begin down in the relegation dogfight. And yes, there were a couple of huge six-pointers on the docket in match day 30. And as we've said off the top, they both did not disappoint. We'll head first to, well, there's nowhere else we could start than the Noivir Stadium and the Kansai Derby to end all Kansai Derbies. So much on the line on Sunday night. Between two Kansai dogfighters, and there was obviously nobody else that we could have on the podcast to chat about the game with than Alan Gibson. Alan, how are you? I imagine you're pretty mentally drained yourself after 90 minutes in that pressure cooker.
Thank you. Good night. Yeah, it was for people who know me well, they know I'm a Gamba Osaka and Vissel Kobe sympathizer, but those who don't know, it was hard work watching my two teams, as it were. Being a J-Soccer magazine editor is trying to be neutral, but, you know, you can't be neutral, can you? And a bit of background for those who don't know, I arrived in 1988 in Japan. There was no Vissel Kobe at that time, but I live in Kobe. So Gamba, or Matsushita Denki, actually, before they became Gamba, was the closest team. So Gamba was my team, and you can't abandon a team like that, can you? But I do believe in local support, and I live in Kobe, so when they were formed in 95, suddenly I had two teams. And that's why I have that kind of a favoritism, as it were, for those two. So watching them both fighting for their life on the weekend was quite amazing, and it was very interesting. It was hard work because I'm in the press section there, and on the left are all these Gamba coaches and staff that I've known for many years. And then just in front of me were Vissel coaches and the off-duty players. So I was sitting there stony-faced and not celebrating anything for the whole game, so that I didn't upset either ones there. I would have much preferred a Gamba Osaka win, I think, because I think, you know, from what I can see from the remaining games, Vissel Kobe, apart from having the extra game in hand as well, have better form and more chance of getting more points. So a Gamba win would have been nice to settle my nerves for both of the teams. But in the end, what a win, eh?
Yeah, absolutely incredible. So, yeah, as we said, a very highly charged atmosphere. And, Alan was walking on eggshells by the sound of it. But, what an occasion it was. And, Sam, there was so much on the line, obviously, for both of these teams. Again, a little bit of a J-League history lesson, that both of these clubs went down together at the end of the 2012 J1 season. And, for so much of this season, Kobe had sunk down into the bottom two and the automatic relegation places. They did win one of their games in hand at home against the FC Tokyo on Wednesday night. That saw them move up to 16th, and that took them above Fukuoka on goal difference and to within a point of Gamba. So, so much on the line between these two teams. They obviously haven't served up much in the way of good football this season. That's why they were down in the in the bottom four or five places at kickoff. But this game, a highly charged atmosphere, and plenty of talking points throughout the game as well.
Oh, yeah, very much so. I'm sure we'll dive into all the refereeing decisions later. But I thought both teams attacked this game. I thought Vissel were probably the better side in the first half. They had more of the chances. Gamba had to hold on a little bit. But then Gamba's response at the start of the second half, I thought, was very good. Obviously, they score at that in that stage as well. So, yeah, it was a really open game, I thought, much better than the quality of football we saw in the reverse fixture earlier in the season, because that really showed why both teams were down here. But, yeah, you could see from the occasion that it meant so much to both teams. I agree with Alan. I think Gamba needed the win maybe a little bit more here. I know that Kobe were lower in the table, but yeah, you felt like Kobe have got the momentum a little bit more with them, whereas Gamba, yeah, they've been very shaky for a while now, and their fixtures are difficult. So yeah, and the manner and the way that they've lost this game as well is going to be a really difficult one to pick up from, pick the team up from. I know there were a few arguments at the end of the game between players. It's not the first time in a derby that Gamba players have been ending the game arguing with each other. So yeah, they're in a really difficult spot now, but this was a huge game coming into it, and I think the result could be very pivotal.
Most definitely. All right. So again, Alan, we're providing a bit of history here and a background to your appearance on the podcast. So many listeners will be aware, some not, that you're also a qualified referee. So as Sam said, there were a few decisions that we need to get your thoughts on, as well as the game as a whole. So both teams had goals disallowed in this game before Gamba ultimately took the lead early in the second half. The first disallowed goal was for Kobe's Yoshinori Muto inside the first 15 minutes. And Sam and I have just briefly chatted about it in the green room, and we're both of the opinion that this was a little bit harsh to penalise Muto for jumping into Gamba keeper Masaki Higashiguchi. I guess in instances like these, keepers do tend to be they do tend to always get the benefit of these decisions, even though I don't think Muto's done anything especially wrong. He doesn't raise his arms as he jumps with Higashiguchi. He's never going to get the ball, of course, as Higashiguchi has the benefit of being able to use his arms. But there is definite contact in midair, but I'm not sure that Muto is necessarily the instigator and deserves to be punished for it. What was your take on that?
Well, I think the referee was probably a little bit swayed by the fact that there were I don't know how many thousand blue and black fans shouting, screaming at him in a split second there. I think the key point is that the players clashed off the ground. Keeper always gets it, justifiably or not. If two players go up and one is a forward and one is a keeper and they're off the ground and they clash, it's pretty much always certain that the keeper's going to get penalised. But it looked to me as if Higashiguchi even dropped the ball, but maybe because of Muto. I thought it was a bit harsh. As a referee, I would have thought about it a lot. But the referees, they can't do that in the situations like that. It wasn't a thing that could be covered by VAR because the ball was still in play. And it wasn't for a penalty or a red card or anything. So the referee had to make his decision and get on with the game. And yeah, I guess it was always going to go for the keeper, but Muto was harshly dealt with. Yes, I agree.
And so, Alan, how did you feel the remainder of the first half went then? We can come on to, obviously, Gamba's disallowed goal, and then shortly after that, taking the lead through Leandro Pereira. But, we've mentioned the occasion and how highly charged it was. And, Sam's mentioned the fact that, these two teams really attacked it. Did you feel either team had an advantage and had built up any momentum in the game heading into the halftime break? Either of them could feel slightly better as to how the first 45 had gone, or rather how it had come to an end?
No, I think one team had the advantage and looking good, and then another team went back up, and I mean both teams were going for it, and you mentioned the charged atmosphere, and I remember thinking how loud it was, and I hadn't heard a game this loud for so long, and I was thinking, yeah, great to have cheering, and then I realized they weren't cheering at all. I mean, it wasn't a cheering game. It was just all the drums and the hand claps, and it was both teams were just going for it. So it was a really good atmosphere for sure. And I think each team had their, as Sam said, each team had their little section. And at halftime, I think obviously Gamba came out roaring in the second half. So I think they were probably happy to go level at the break, especially with Muto's disallowed goal too. But it was an amazing atmosphere, and I really looked forward to the second half.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. And Gamba definitely made the brighter start to the second 45 minutes, Sam. Then, and I mean, yeah, I, I there was some debate over the disallowed Kobe goal early doors, but I don't think there's really any at all about Gumba's disallowed goal, is there? Leandro Pereira was definitely offside when that set piece was sent into the box. I think it was Patrick, wasn't it, who finished it off. But, yeah, ultimately, this is a fairly line ball decision, but the linesman's got it correct. And, I think we can all accept that and move on.
This is absolutely offside. You know, it just goes a little bit too early. It's a little unfortunate. It doesn't really know much about what's happening. And, yeah, Patrick's goalie took it well, but, yeah, it was correctly disallowed.
All right, then. So then in the 55th minute, Gumba took the lead, and it obviously, capped their excellent start to the second half. Across into the box from Keisuke Kurokawa was, I want to say bundled home, but that's probably not doing it justice. I don't think he made the sweetest contact he'll ever make on a ball, will he, Leandro Pereira? But it was enough to send the ball past Hiroki Ikura and into the net at Ikura's right-hand post. Pereira finishing at the near post from Kurokawa's delivery. And, we've seen Kobe struggle in so many games this season, Sam. But, yeah, for them having to come from behind was something that they hadn't done in J1 all season to win the game. So that obviously was going to be a very long road to hoe for them. But for Gumba, this was the lifeline they were looking for.
It was, and it was a really good piece of football, actually, to build up to this goal. Meshino, Saito and Kurokawa all involved. The run from Kurokawa is fantastic to meet Saito's pass. So, yeah, really well-crafted goal, and it's exactly what they deserve for the start of their second half. And, yeah, you do worry about Kobe every time they go down, because we've all said it, they've got the players, but do they have the mentality in this sort of situation? And fair play to them, they did respond. I mean, they were still under pressure at the back with Gambra counter-attacking a few times, but they defended really well. And I was also worried, like, Tula had gone off injured very early in the first half. And then Kobayashi has come in, and Kobayashi is a decent young player, but he's got mistakes in him. He's made a few mistakes this season, and Kikuchi is only just back from injury. So you're worried about that kind of young partnership, and how is that going to deal with the threat from Gamba? But yeah, after going behind, they were exposed a little bit more, but they defended really well. So I think you've got to give a lot of credit to Vissel Kobe for their response, because yeah, at that point, yeah, heads could easily have dropped.
Most definitely. And it wasn't at all confusing, Alan, that Kobe had two Yuki Kobayashis on the pitch for roughly the last 30 odd minutes of the first half. But Conning dancing around the point. Gumba took the lead in the first 10 minutes of the second half. But at half time, the Kobe manager, Takayuki Yoshida, introduced Yuya Osako off the bench to replace one of the Yuki Kobayashis. It was Osako's first league appearance since match day 25 on the 13th of August away up in Sapporo. And, he was to go on to make a huge impact, obviously, in this game, turning it on its head in the last 10 minutes. But, we've obviously seen Muto carry the load for Kobe up front while Osaka was being out. So, yeah, the fact that they were able to welcome him back and we could see how important he was to them in the second 45 minutes, that's obviously going to be a huge boost for Kobe in the remaining six league games that they've got to play, provided, of course, that they can keep him fit in the meantime.
I think that's the key. I see him in the games when he's not playing, and he's got his it's left, I don't know which ankle, right ankle, I think, heavily wrapped all the time. I think he's basically one of these players that is now chronically injured and doesn't rest enough. So he's obviously being handled carefully. And he was handled very carefully indeed to bring him on in the second half and score the goals. I mean, they've also got Stefan Mugosha, who they signed from Korea. And I think that was a bit of a panic move, perhaps, to get another goal-scoring guy who then came across and got injured and unofficially got COVID and then got injured and COVID and still hardly done anything at all. And I think he also arrived just the week that the manager got removed and Yoshida came in again, so I'm not sure he's had a chance to prove himself. But this will have plenty of players available now, and if they can juggle them enough correctly, they'll be fine. I think when you mentioned Tula going off and Yuki Kobayashi came on, and whether it was Patrick or Leandro Pereira, he was stunning. He had them in the pocket all the time. He was winning all the challenges, and I thought it was actually Kikuchi who was Kikuchi looked like he was trying too hard in this game. He's usually there. I mean, he made some great saves and some great tackles, but he also moved forward a lot more than he usually does, and he beat a few players. He even went down the right wing once. But he ended up with his final ball was his final pass was often given to the opposition, and I think I know because I spoke to him after, he was not happy with his performance at all. And if he sticks to defending, I think he's going to be a key player in the coming weeks. They also switched Ino from right wing or right midfield to right back and took out Yamakawa, who's been having a decent game, but Ino is a class player. And it helped in that case. He's still going forward and bombing down the wings when he needs to. But then someone like, in this case, Sasaki, he's a completely different player. He adds a bit of grit in the middle there too. And Yuruki is just amazing on the left. He's a great player. So they've got the players. Now they've got to make a team and, let's get those results. But getting back to Osako, yeah, he was he came on and he did the business. And I'm sure you'd like to discuss at least the penalty and the second goal now, I guess. So let's go ahead.
Yeah, well, it was obviously a huge flashpoint in the game. Kobe had a couple of half chances after Leandro Pereira had put Gumba in front. And then, inside the last 10 minutes, what was initially ruled as a foul, a free kick to Gumba in the box for a foul, in inverted commas, by Yoshinori Muto, was checked over by VAR. And after the referee was encouraged to have a look, it was overturned, and indeed a penalty was awarded to Kobe for a foul by Yuya Fukuda, wasn't it? So a flashpoint in this game, Alan, and we need to get your thoughts on it, your first impressions on the incident, if you could see from where you were sitting inside the ground, and then I'm sure you've seen it back numerous times. So did the officiating crew come to the correct decision in your mind?
Well, I think they did in the end, but I was surprised that they did. Sam will know, because we actually had a little exchange going on just after the decisions won. But I basically tweeted, well, that looked like a foul on Muto, but it's been given, and I was like, that was it. And then suddenly it was VAR, as I was talking, next, it's gone to VAR. And then Sam was saying something about Muto perhaps getting VAR'd for going in with his studs up, perhaps. And I was still there like, nah, I think Muto was fouled. And then the VAR gave it to him. So my initial thoughts were right, but I'm not sure if that was the right reasoning. So I did have a good look at it. And I think the J-League judge replay in particular has mentioned this season. This first time I've really heard it mentioned at all is initiation by the forward, where he gets in the way of the challenge intentionally and then gets fouled, which to me sounds like a foul, to be honest, right? But they seem to be saying that if the player sort of drags his leg or sticks his leg out where it's not supposed to be and then he gets kicked, then it shouldn't be a foul anymore. I think the first time it was really looked at closely, again on J-League judge replay, was when Kuroki was taken out from behind in a game for Consadole Sapporo, and it looks such an obvious penalty. And they showed it on the J-League judge replay where the ball came. Kuroki saw the player coming, he turned into him, he put his leg in the way, and then he got taken out. Now, to me, that is a foul, but it was judged as initiated. And in this case, if they're going to be consistent, I feel the same way. I think Muto probably got there first and might have got the foul, especially anywhere else on the pitch. And it certainly wasn't a foul by Muto anyway, so that was an error at the start, but that's what VAR is there for. So in the end, I think Muto intentionally or not initiated the contact. But in the end, I think the right decision was made, because Fukuda comes up behind him and, takes his shin out and his calf out, and Muto goes down. And I think in the end, the correct decision was made. Over to you, Sam.
Yeah, this was a really interesting one, because obviously you're watching from the stand. I've got the TV, and obviously he gives a free kick straight away. So initially I'm thinking, okay, he thinks that Muto has gone in with his studs raised and they want to check if it's a red card. That's the initial thought that I had of what's happening, because Muto, he has like a very exaggerated lift of his leg to try and get in the way of Fukuda. He tries to buy the foul. I mean, it's most people would say it's quite clever the way that he did that, because he does get himself in front of Fukuda. Fukuda has no choice but to kind of go through him. So it is initiated contact, but is it just clever from the striker just to draw the foul and win the penalty? Because, yeah, they check the... I'm sure as part of the review, they do check the way that Muto brings his foot in, and it's not quite studs up. It's not like he's endangering a player with the way he does it. So I think in the end, I think it's clever from Muto. I think it's very unlucky for Fukuda the way that he brings him down. But yeah, I bow to your judgment on this as well, Alan. I'll say it is the correct decision. But yeah, it's just, it's one for Gamba way. If that's given against you, I think you're going to be a little frustrated, because it is all Muto's doing in the way that the penalty comes about.
Yeah, it's a real grey area in the law. But, yeah, as Sam says, a tough one for Gumba to take. But, yeah, ultimately, perhaps the correct decision. And, well, anyway, it was left to Osako to hold his nerve from the spot. And, yes, he did, sending Higashiguchi the wrong way in the 83rd minute to level things up. But there was a definite sting in the tail in the in second half stoppage time. And, unfortunately, again, for Gumba, they were on the wrong end of the stick. And their summer signing, Musashi Suzuki, gave the ball away in midfield. And from there, it was, pretty much a horror show for Gumba, as I guess if their supporters were watching on, they were probably expecting this inevitable outcome that came after Suzuki gave the ball away in midfield. As I said, Kobe raced through the centre. A terrific advantage was played by the referee, and the play ended with Muto passing the ball into Osako, who set himself up for a volleyed finish with a very short backlift, a tremendous contact on the ball that flashed into the net past Higashiguchi. And, wild scenes is a massive understatement. Chris and Lolo from J-League Journeys were there, and they put a three-minute video out of limbs in the home end, basically, pretty much straight after the game. So if you haven't checked that out yet, get over to YouTube and have a look at J-League Journeys' latest mini video. I'm sure their full video from the Novi is going to be extremely entertaining. But, yeah, that three-minute clip was just absolute raw emotion. And, the Kobe supporters and obviously the players, just a massive outpouring of joy, relief, so many emotions at Osako's second of the night going in so late on. And Sam, it was just a massive way for this game to end. As we said, a heartbreaker for Gumba and Musashi Suzuki, especially giving the ball away. But from there, I guess for Kobe, any goal was going to be great for them to win it. But yeah, it was a terrific finish from Osako at the end of the day.
Oh, absolutely glorious finish. It was a touch of class, really. A great ball into him from Muto, but the way he controls it and finds the bottom corner, it's a terrific goal, and it's just what Vissel needed, really. I mean, yes, Suzuki's going to have nightmares for the way that he gave the ball away, and Gamba suitably punished for it. Yeah, terrific for him. It brings up an interesting question. Obviously, the national team was announced last week. Osako was injured, so it wasn't picked in that. Where do you, Alan, I'll go first, where do you see Osako in terms of Japan's preparation for the World Cup? I know he's got these injury issues, and would you want to see him maybe go and train with the national team if he's still in the plans for the World Cup? Would you like him just to be at least training with the national team during this last break, because it's the last time that Japan will get together before the World Cup? Or do you think maybe these injuries are going to limit his opportunities and maybe it's time to move on from him for this World Cup?
I think he's essential for the World Cup squad. There's no one else like him that can. I mean, I argue with people all the time, and maybe we're going to argue here, or some of our listeners will argue. But what Osako does is incredible. I mean, he makes Japan don't really play with a centre forward, but he's as close as they get at the moment, because they don't have Musashi Suzuki is maybe there, but he's not ready yet again. And, the likes of Patrick and even Thiago Santana is being mentioned these days as a kind of a bustling centre forward that Japan lacks. But I'm not sure they need it, because playing with that, for want of a better word, the false nine that the Spanish always used to use, and maybe they still do. Osako is there, and he takes the ball and he holds it up and he creates space for the other three or four forwards that are coming through. He lays it off, doesn't he? Or when he gets the ball, he finishes, as you can see. and his heading ability too. I mean, if he goes up for the header, you know, you get behind him because the ball's coming. And I think we've got so much talent in there, like, you know, Furuhashi and Maeda, you know, just to mention a Celtic player, Kubo, Minamino, Junior Ito is definitely there on the right wing, of course. But we can't play all of these players, and I don't think any of them do what Osako does. You know, they're all direct players or dribbling players, but Osako is the player that stands there, holds up the ball, distributes it, makes space for others, gets stuck in when he needs to, and finishes. So for me, he's definitely needed at the World Cup. On the other hand, Moriyasu knows him well enough already, and all the other players know him well enough already that save him, save his energy and his injuries, and don't worry about the training that might need to be done. They can train without him because he's the man in the middle that holds it all up while they all do the work around him anyway. So I would say save him, especially for Vissel Kobe as well. And please use him at the World Cup. If you have any alternatives, please go ahead now.
I have no alternatives. I'm glad you want Osako, though. I don't want to get into that argument with you. I think he's perfect for the way that Moriyasu is going to set up his team and the opposition that Japan are going to face at that World Cup. I would like him training with them, to be honest. With the, you've got game plans you've got to figure out against Spain, against Germany. You don't have to run him into the ground in the friendlies or anything, but I think just getting that, making sure there's that understanding, because it has been a little while between before or since Osaka has played with these players, he's had various injuries. So I would like him there. There's various, I can understand why you'd think to save him, but if he's training at Kobe, he might as well train with Japan. That's just my thought on it. But yeah, I think Osako has to be part of the reckoning, because I don't think Japan are the same team without him. But yeah, Ben, any other thoughts on Osako?
No, yeah, agreed. I mean, we often bemoan Mr. Moriyasu and, you know, the product he puts out there. But yeah, you're both right for the way he wants to play. He wants his teams to play, and how Japan will set up at the World Cup, then yes, Osako is perfect for it. We obviously like the flashy new things, and we maybe after this World Cup cycle is complete, maybe we'll be able to get used to Kyogo Furuhashi, Kaoru Mitoma, etc., starting for up front for Japan. But yes, for now it's got to be Osako. And take your point, Sam, it would be great if they could fly him over for a few days, but I could see why Kobe might not be a massive fan of that idea. Obviously, if they were playing their two friendlies in Japan, then you could certainly make that happen much easier on a logistics basis. But for now, I imagine Kobe would like him wrapped in cotton wool, and that's probably how they're going to handle things before they travel to Fukuoka when the league resumes on the 1st of October. I did must apologize. I did earlier. Kobe don't have 6 games left; they have 5, of course, 6 before they played Gamba on Sunday night. So yeah, Alan, what can you say about that finish from Osako? The scenes deep into second half stoppage time when Kobe, who had of course won only 5 of their first 24 league games this season, with this win, they've now won 3 of their last 5. So, they've hauled themselves out of the relegation zone for the first time since the Clinton administration. And, obviously they appear to be finishing with somewhat of a wet sail. And, the scenes, they must have just been absolutely epic.
It was rather cool, wasn't it? I think Osako reminded me of what I do in futsal every week. It was very cool. Well, at least I try to. And I modeled that on Dennis Bergkamp and Thierry Henry. I mean, I immediately thought of it was Bergkamp-esque when he did it, that little one little flick, and the finish was lovely. It was definitely what was needed. It was a touch of class from a great player. So it's probably saved Vissel's hide, and he's probably saved them overall with his goals this season, I think.
All right, then. So the Kobe move out of the bottom 3, as I said, and they zip up to 13th goal difference ahead of Fukuoka and Shonan. And, now a point clear of Kyoto and 2 ahead of Gumba. So, yeah, Kobe have five games to go. Their last two, obviously, very daunting. They travel to Kawasaki and host Yokohama F. Marinos in the final two match days. But before then, as I said, they travel to Fukuoka, then host Hiroshima and Shonan. So, I don't know, 5 points, maybe even seven possible from those three games, and that might be enough to wrap up their survival. Sam, on the other hand, Gumba have four games left. They host Kashiwa when we return from the international break, then travel to F. Marinos, where they do have a decent record for whatever that's worth at that time. Then they host Iwata, who will probably already be mathematically relegated by then, and then travel to Kashima on the final day. So it's a bit of an up and down a remaining fixture list for Gumba. Two wins would be absolutely precious for them, and if they could get 7 or 8 points out of their remaining four games, that might be enough for them. Which way do you see it, and which one of these two teams is in the most danger, do you think?
Oh, I think Gumba have to be in the most dangerous. Obviously, their position, the game, like Kashiwa and Marinos next up. I mean, maybe before Kashiwa's result this weekend, I might be thinking they're sliding down a little bit. They might be there for the taking. But yeah, they showed that they're still up for a fight this weekend. And Marinos won't, I don't think, have wrapped up the title by the time they face them. So that's two horrible games to try and get points out of. Yes, if they're still involved, and then they could face Jubilo, who might be relegated by the time they face them. And then Kashima, who... I don't know what's happened to Kashima this season. So it's not terrible to end it, but I think they might be a little bit too far adrift after these next two games. So, yeah, that's really difficult for them. But, yeah, Vissel, I think, the game against Avispa is huge. If they can win that, then I think they're absolutely fine. But Avispa will be thinking exactly the same thing. So we're not out of the woods yet with Vissel. And, another good six-pointer when the J-League returns.
Most definitely. So, Alan, yes, Gumba do, in some respects, it's a silly question. I mean, there's only 2 points between the teams, but their recent form, Gumba obviously have taken a big hit here as well, mentality-wise, with this sucker punch of Osako's late double. So how do they pick themselves up? How do they handle this international break? How do they get themselves ready for the return to the Panasonic Stadium when they host Kashiwa on the 1st of October? Because I imagine for the players it'll take a bit to get over what just happened to them on Sunday night.
Indeed, it's probably a good thing that they're not playing on Wednesday or even within a week. I mean, they've got plenty of time to get over it. Hiroshi Matsuda is a very experienced coach, who's their manager, caretaker perhaps, but not by name. I actually managed to get a few words with him before the game, and he was very relaxed. And I asked him if he was going to be there next year, and he said, back in English, that depends on these results, huh? So,
okay.
Obviously. So he's a very good manager. And it's Matsuda. He needs to raise his team. I think the problem might be that if Jubilo Atta are already relegated, they'll be under no pressure whatsoever, and in fact maybe had to prove something, and that might be the game that Gumba lose out of this for.
It's going to be fascinating, obviously, and so much on the line for both of these Kansai clubs in their remaining fixtures this season. Before we move off these two teams, Sam, was there anything that you wanted to ask Alan specifically about either of them before we wrap up the rest of the dogfight?
Yeah, before we leave Gumba, Alan, Takashi Osami, obviously a horrible injury at the start of the season. He was back in training. Do you know anything about maybe a chance for him to come back in these last four games? And could he be the lift that Gumba need to get out of this situation?
I asked someone in the know about this in particular, and said, are we going to see Osami on the bench in the next game, perhaps? Because it's another couple of weeks now, right? Obviously, this is not the manager, and I couldn't ask Mr. Matsuda too much at the start of the game, because I was leaning over the fence and not supposed to be there. But I think that Osami is in full training and has been making contact and tackles and running. I wonder whether they're going to fit him in, but I guess, of course, they can. I mean, Mr. Matsuda seems to prefer his Brazilians up front. Leandro Pereira and Patrick have not really seen much action in the last year and three quarters. I think they're both, well, Leandro Pereira has been injured a lot and also had COVID, and I think everyone at Gamba had COVID, to be honest. But Patrick has also always been a kind of super sub. I think for the last probably the last two or three seasons, he's not really been a starter for me. He's just basically a guy who comes on 65 or 70 minutes and does the business if we're lucky. So I think the Usami will be more of a Meshino, who's been sort of shunted out to the left of midfield, or even a Yamami, who started the season well, but then Gamba got in Musashi Suzuki and then changed the manager twice, I think. So I'm not sure if Usami could be perhaps the spark that brings the team, as we were discussing that. He could be the spark that brings the team together and gives them some momentum. So they might just throw him on the bench for the next game anyway, just to have the fans with something to shout about if they're allowed to, or drum about and clap about, and perhaps motivate the team a little bit more to win something for him. So, yep, technically he seems to be ready, but they're taking it easy. But in 2 weeks' time, who knows?
Well, yeah, could Usami be the boost that Gamba need to fire them out of the drop zone in their remaining four games? Their supporters certainly hope so, and they could certainly do with a pick me up after the manner of a Sunday night's defeat. But all smiles on the Kobe side, and huge celebrations obviously at the full time whistle. As I said, they moved out of the drop zone, back to back wins, and yes, their third home game of the week, basically in the span of 8 days, has netted them 7 points and hauled them up the table, as we mentioned. All right, so also in desperate need of a victory on Saturday night were Avispa Fukuoka. They hadn't won in 8 games in the league, but they hosted a relegation dogfight 6-pointer against the Shimizu S-Pulse, who were 12th in the table at kickoff, 4 points above them. But after a barn burner at the Best Denki Stadium, that deficit is back to just a single point. Fukuoka winning 3-2. After Shimizu first took the lead through Rayon Yamahara's ball in from the left. Sam, I could be cheeky here and try and claim this as a shot, but obviously, as clear as day, Yamahara crossed. Basically, the ball flashed past about five or six different players in the centre, in two different batches, and somehow went in at Masaki Murakami's far post. Flashed across the box. It's a bit strong as well, I think. It basically just dribbled across the box, and much to Murakami's bemusement, ended up in the back of his net. But 7 minutes after falling behind, Shun Nakamura equalized for Fukuoka, and then Yuya Yamagishi was to be the man of the hour for the hosts. He put them in front 3 minutes before the break, and then 4 minutes into the second half bagged his second of the evening, only for Golden Boot leader, and yes, that snuck up on us, didn't it, Tiago Santana, to pull a goal back for S-Pulse from the penalty spot in the 60th minute. But from there, with half an hour to rescue a point, S-Pulse were unable to do so. And Sam, this game certainly lived up to its billing, a pressure cooker indeed as well at the Best Denki Stadium. And to say this was a massive 3 points for Fukuoka is indeed a massive understatement.
Yep, they played like a team that absolutely had to win, and they went out and did so. Great response, especially going behind. I mean, Shimizu, they took the lead and then just sat back, as they kind of have done in a couple of times in the last few weeks. They, get in front and think, oh my word, we're in front and we need to win this game. Let's sit back and then just invite all the pressure. But it was a little bit of quality from Nakamura, a great free kick. That's got a good ring to it, hasn't it, a Nakamura free kick. And then, they played really well after that. Yamagishi, I thought, was really active. Just his little bits of movement in and around the penalty area, they just couldn't deal with him. And, he got... There's a little bit of fortune to this first goal. I'd like Alan's view, actually, because it hits Takashi Shichi on the shoulder / upper arm. I know a lot of Shimizu supporters were thinking this should have been handball. It was given, it was disallowed initially, I think. I think they thought it was offside, but the goal was eventually awarded. Are you happy with this goal to stand?
It was obviously not offside, but the linesman had flagged for it. So that was the first error, but that's thankfully what VAR does. So they corrected that error. It was not offside. I did feel, I didn't really look at it close enough, or enough times, or a big enough screen perhaps to say that it was handball. The ball was already in the net. So technically VAR has to prove otherwise, that it was definitely handball, to then disallow it, unless they were looking at it for offside. And then it gets complicated. To me, it was the ball hit the arm, whether it was accidental or not. The key point, thankfully, the rule changed since long ago now, is if the advantage is gained from the ball hitting the arm, whether it was intentional or not, then it should be a handball. So in this case, I believe that it could have definitely gone out for a handball, but it was definitely not offside.
Yeah, it was a really weird one. There's like the rule about where does the shoulder end and where does the arm start and all that. And it's so difficult to determine. So if it is like, OK, we've determined on the field it's not handball, we have to prove it the other ways, then maybe there's not enough evidence to overturn that part of the decision. But yeah, it's a really interesting one. And I wish J-League Judge Replay would actually broadcast to me, because I'd again like to see this episode.
Yeah, there's certainly going to be a lot of fodder for them again coming up from this past weekend. I think they do, yeah, definitely have some tough editorial decisions to make, actually, because oftentimes there's a lot more than three or four decisions that a lot of us would like to see discussed. But yeah, whether this will make the cut as one of the most egregious or line ball decisions from the weekend, I guess we'll wait and see in the coming week. But ultimately, what does this mean for Fukuoka, Alan? And as I said, it was a long time between drinks, a long time between league wins for them. And I think a lot of us had presumed S-Pulse to be safe, or with maybe just within one victory of safety. But after a lot of the teams in the dogfight had a successful few days in terms of Kobe, or weekend in terms of Fukuoka or Shonan, it was too presumptuous for us to consider S-Pulse to be even on the fringes of safety. So for Fukuoka, this victory, long overdue and much needed, this could be the kickstart for the rest of their season.
Indeed, it's a big one. I think it's about 15 games they've played, and they've only won three games, and all three wins were against rivals. Jubilo away 1-0, Kyoto Sanga at home 1-0, were the last time they won. And that was back in early July. And then they've beaten Avispa here. So basically that's 3 6-pointers that they've managed to win. And S-Pulse, they looked like they were sneaking away, but I don't think they were. But to be honest, for me, until about three or four games ago, it was all the way up to FC Tokyo, sorry, Ben, were still looking quite dangerous to me. I mean, I'm not sure if it's three or four games, but I remember looking at the table and it was like eighth position was still within reach of the team in 17th. So it's still like, eight teams that are fighting for this now, 2, 4. See, I've got it in front of me. Yeah, eight teams, if you include Consadole Sapporo, who are probably safe because they have an extra game in hand as well. But we thought that about S-Pulse before this weekend, didn't we? So, this is a major win for Avispa Fukuoka and tragedy for S-Pulse, who have only 2 points on Kyoto Sanga in 16th place. So, I mean, it's going to be a big tight one. I'd like to know, and maybe Sam would like to know too, why are we not seeing Yuito Suzuki back on the field yet?
Yeah, well, I can tell you is he got injured, obviously, for the under-21s. It was confirmed that he eventually, I think in August, that he got injured in June. I think they list it as an intermedius muscle contusion. So if you know what that means, good for you. I have no idea. But yeah, he's been back for the last four games on the bench. But he's just, because he got injured, they obviously decided we're going to splash the cash on a load of attackers. So they got Anui in, they got Pikachu in. Carlinhos has played pretty well, and you can't take Thiago Santana out of that team. So he's found his opportunities quite limited, which is really harsh on him, given how well he'd performed prior to that tournament. But yeah, they are generally sticking with that front four, and he might get a couple of minutes off the bench. I think he got 20 minutes in this game, so that was reasonable. But yeah, he's still not quite to fitness, and yeah, has just a lot of traffic now ahead of him.
And I think you're missing a big thing here, Sam, when you say they went out and collected all these attackers and they got Pikachu. Collect them all. Okay, never mind.
I've not been good with my Pokemon puns. I mean, Ben is the go-to guy for that.
Yeah, he's not even trying, Alan, but he made that one. Yeah, maybe. Yes. He's still looking for that first goal. I don't know what's wrong with him. Those 100,000 volts just are not clicking into gear for Pikachu. It's a crying shame. But for S-Bolts, yeah, he's got to sort himself out because, as we said, this win for Fukuoka brings them back to within a point of Shimizu. And overall, Sam, I think we saw it last week against Shonan when they, obviously seconds away from hanging on for a vital victory there. But again, you've mentioned it here. I mean, it didn't take Fukuoka long to equalize after they initially went ahead through Yamahara, again, in fortunate circumstances. But yeah, it's just it's slightly deer in the headlights here from S-Bolts. Are they feeling the pressure? I mean, it's obviously understandable. But they had seemed to be clicking into some sort of form. And as I said, they kicked out of the bottom three. And we thought they might have done enough to edge themselves up to safety. But again, this is another example of something that we saw happen with Shonan earlier on in the season where they'd edged their way. They'd stormed out of the bottom three, hadn't they? And up the table when they've slowly been dragged back into it. And it appears that S-Bolts are feeling the pressure and the same thing is happening to them.
Yeah, as soon as they kind of got to the front of the pack of these teams trying to escape relegation, they've just kind of panicked because they knew what they had to do beforehand. They were behind, they have to go out and attack, and it suited the way that they're playing. But now they get in front and they kind of just worry that, oh no, okay, we've got to keep this lead, we've got to keep this lead, and they drop deep, and their defence is rubbish. So there's no point in dropping deep and trying to sit back with this defence because every team will pick them apart. I mean, Avispa are hardly the greatest attacking team, but they managed to pick them apart in this game. They've got so many good attacking players. They've just got to use them and try and outscore teams. I think that's the way they have to go. But yeah, I don't know whether they just got to the front of that queue and then thought, okay, we've done enough now and started partying. I don't know if all of us on the bandwagon just had a celebratory drink a bit too early and we've now crashed it. But yeah, it's all gone a little bit pear-shaped for them. At least the next game they've got, it's going to focus them. It's Jubilo at home. You've got to go out and win that game. It's almost the perfect fixture, I think, for them just to get themselves together and go again. But yeah, these last two games have been really worrying because Shonan and Avispa, perhaps the two worst attacking teams, have come out and dominated them for large parts of the game. And that shouldn't be happening.
Indeed. All right. So, yeah, the pressure beginning to tell on S-Pulse, it appears. But, as Sam's just mentioned there and set me up for one of the best segues of the season so far, S-Pulse's next game is at home against their prefectural rivals, Jubilo Iwata. So one to look forward to when the league resumes after the international break. And Iwata, well, they've obviously been cut adrift now. Kobe surging out of the bottom three has seen them basically cut adrift for the first time all season. They went into the weekend 5 points behind second from bottom Fukuoka at that point. But Fukuoka winning, Kobe winning, and also Shonan picking up a point in the game we're coming on to after this one meant that, Iwata had it all to do. And when they were 2-0 down to Cerezo Osaka, it looked like we could finally draw the curtains on their season. But Alan, Jubilo do deserve enormous credit here. They had fallen behind to goals from Adam Taggart and Ryosuke Shindo. Taggart had missed a number of chances to add to Cerezo's lead that he would love to have back, I'm sure, and did have the ball in the net again, only for the goal to be disallowed for offside. But Shota Kaneko gave Jubilo a lifeline in the 57th minute. And then Shindo, who scored a Cerezo second, went and scored Jubilo second as well, sliding in to meet a cross in from the right, but diverting it past his goalkeeper, Keisuke Shimizu, who was relieving Kim Jin-hyun of his duties on Saturday night. So Iwata, they'd look dead and buried coming into this game. And again, 2-0 down to Cerezo. It might be one of their last stands in J1 this season. So they wanted to try and turn things around in front of the Yamaha Stadium faithful. And they rewarded their supporters for their support with a stirring fight back and a 2-2 draw.
And they did it without Yuto Suzuki on the right wing there, and with the aging Oi in the middle because Ricardo Grassa was also suspended. They were resting the 42-year-old Endo, but I'm not sure. I think from what I've seen, he still contributes a lot to games. So, I mean, they had a couple of reserves in there too. And of course, they had Sugimoto up front, so basically they're playing with 10 men. Kaneko's goal was class. I mean, the way he took it and then sort of just took one touch and swerved it into the corner. I mean, that was wonderful stuff, and he'll be up for playing against Espols. It's going to be a very interesting game, but yep, they did very well in this game, because this is the one we're talking about. Taggart's goal was very nice, the way he just shuffled it to one side and finished off beautifully. His other disallowed goal was also a wonderful finish, and hopefully he keeps that form up for Australia unless they meet Japan in the World Cup. Shindo was a surprise, but he plays not very often, and he scores quite often when he does play. They've got, I believe, some COVID or undisclosed injuries in the camp there, so they had to make some changes. Then the own goal came, of course, so Shindo scored one at each end. The key point, which I hinted on earlier, was when Naoki Kanuma got his red card in the 94th minute, just
by taking
out a man on the halfway line and taking one for the team and keeping the point and perhaps keeping them alive. And they will be up for Shimizu S-Pulse, won't they? So it's not over yet.
Absolutely. And, well, yeah, that action by Kanuma to take out his man just inside the Cerezo half, Sam, that might have been the difference. And yes, Cerezo could easily have scored on the breakaway, literally at the death in the 94th minute. But yeah, as Alan said, Kanuma took one for the team, and that 1 point, whether it will actually factor in or not, whether a Jubilo stay up or go down, well, they at least were able to bank this one at full time. And yeah, Kanuma, his actions made sure of that.
Yeah, perfect defending. I thought it was fantastic. And he basically doffed his cap and walked off straight away. Said, that's my job done. And yeah, he stopped the breakaway and he kept them still in it. I mean, how many times this season have we said Jubilo looked dead and buried in a game, but somehow come away with a draw in it? And it'd be great if that becomes a metaphor for their season, because at the moment, I mean, we all think they're probably dead and buried, but they've got games. They've got 5 games left. They've got the one game in hand against Marinos, which, yeah, that's not the ideal game. But otherwise, Shimizu, who at the moment are beatable, Kashima are definitely beatable. The last two are Gamba and Kyoto, who have got 6-pointers, absolutely beatable. They're not dead and buried yet, Jubilo, as much as they seem to have been all season. And I'm still not really sure how they're in contention at the moment, but they've still got fight in this squad. They did it with so many players missing in this game as well. So, yeah, great credit to them for their response, because it's not like Cerezo are an easy team to come back against either. Generally, if Cerezo are ahead, they deal with that quite comfortably, and they see games out. So, yeah, terrific from Jubilo. What a game we've got after the international break against Shimizu. That really sets up their season. And I'm not backing against Jubilo going and causing maybe a bit of a surprise there.
Yeah, most definitely. So just before we move off this game, Alan, it'll be frustrating for Cerezo, obviously, to drop 2 points to the bottom club after, as we said, taking a 2-0 lead, early in the second half. They would have backed themselves to see the game out from there. And it'll be frustrating for them. They didn't build on Wednesday night's win away at Urawa when Mutsuki Kato scored an excellent goal midway through the first half. And if they had have hung on here, they would have edged to within a point of Hiroshima with a game in hand on Sanfrecce. And Cerezo obviously still in the running for a top three position, but if they had have hung on here, it would have really driven home the fact that they were finishing with a wet sail. So I guess from a Cerezo perspective, ultimately a frustrating evening at the Yamaha Stadium, and definitely a disappointing result to take back to Osaka.
Probably. I think they're probably very disappointed. I think I think very early this season, or was it even last season, when you asked me about the manager, Akio Kogiku, whether he was the man for the job. I think you asked me who should be the man for the job, and I said that Kogiku, who was a caretaker at the time, is the man for the job. And I think he's proved that. He's bought a team that were very average, and they don't really have many stars as such, but they're making a great team. A special mention for Kim Jin-hyun, perhaps, because I think this is the first game he's missed in 3.5 years or so, mm-hmm. presumably COVID, we're not sure. But that was a surprise. But the fact that he also rested Matty Jonic, because he was on the bench, And another forward, Yamada, was on the bench, and I'm not sure where Mutsuki Kato was, but for me, he's the man that should be up front with Taggart. And I wonder if he was just sort of rotating a little against the bottom team and made an error in the end. He also rested, I don't know of any injury, perhaps Sam does, Yamanaka on the left-back position, who is pretty much a starter in every game, compared, especially with Marahashi injured for the season. But they gave Funaki a start. Funaki did score, I think, on his debut, and then scored again the week after. So he's done well, but in his limited time. But I think having Jonic in there, and perhaps Yamanaka, if he was available, would have helped them a lot. So I'm not sure if it was rotation or necessity, but perhaps resting too many players against the bottom team was a little overestimation of what to expect.
Yeah, it's interesting when that happens, because obviously he does make those changes, but they were 2-0 up in the game, so it wasn't necessarily harming them at all. They had taken the lead. The players that come on, and Maikuma, who is just generally a regular, Suzuki has been playing very well, Wejo usually plays well, so it's not like they brought on poor players either. So maybe it was just at the back they were a little bit shaky without Jonic there, without Yamanaka, so maybe it was too many changes. But yeah, it's difficult to tell exactly what was going on, because they got two COVID cases. I know the manager came out and said that Kim missed due to, and it's a go-to expression of poor condition, that could mean COVID, it could mean anything, it genuinely, in my experience. So yeah, it was an interesting one for them. They've obviously got the Levain Cup semi-finals coming up starting in midweek, so it was a balancing act. He had to make a judgment call, can we maybe rest a few players at Jubilo, and it was working. But yeah, maybe it did catch them out in the end. But I still think you've got to give all the credit to Jubilo for their fight back. Because, yeah, that goal from Kaneko especially, I mean, not many teams are denying that. Even with the first 11 on, it was such a good goal.
Indeed. Well said. So, yeah, unfortunate for Cerezo, but your full credit to Iwata for, well, basically keeping their season alive, keeping hope alive down at the Yamaha Stadium. But as Sam says, yeah, a number of their remaining games do look winnable, and indeed are six-pointers. So, yes, it's all to play for still for Jubilo. Their situation does look quite perilous. 6 points behind 16th-placed Kyoto, and obviously a huge amount of goal difference as well, makes it technically seven. They've shown, as we've said all season, they've been up for a fight, and they've scrapped back in a number of games. So, hopefully for them, they can keep their season going for as long as possible, and keep their survival hopes alive. So, it was an interesting week down in the dogfight. There's no question about that. Another team that claimed a valuable point was Shonan and Belmare. They were at home to Urawa, and that game ended at 0-0 at the Lemon Gas Stadium to complete a bit of a dirty week for Reds. As we said, they lost at home to Cerezo on Wednesday night. They would have been hoping to bounce back down in Hiratsuka on Saturday night. But at Belmare, they seem to have the majority of the clear-cut chances in this game, Sam, although Kasper Juncker and Ataru Esaka did have opportunities for Reds, not to sell them short. But especially in the first half hour, Belmare looked well and truly up for this, and a number of chances went begging, and notably a back post header from Hirokazu Ishihara when it looked like for all money he was going to beat Shusaku Nishikawa, but basically mistimed his jump, and I'm not sure if he actually headed the ball or not, but bundled the ball into the side netting. But for Shonan, another positive performance, and another point to show to build off that late show away at Shimizu last week, and that keeps them above Kyoto and indeed out of the drop zone.
Yeah, on paper, it's a good point. I think the balance of play, I think they'd be disappointed not to have won this game. And first, I need to apologise to Reds supporters, because last week I said they're such good form, they're going to have a massive say at top and bottom, and they've put in two of the limpest performances ever after that. So sorry for that, but at least I guess I'm jinxing mid-table teams and not teams in the dogfight or fighting for the title. But yeah, this was a poor performance from Reds. I thought Shonan were the better team. And a bit like last week, I think this is a game that they could have won and maybe should have won and might rue the missed opportunities. They made a really interesting call by Shuto Machino, had just been called up to the national team. They're a team that don't score many goals, and they decided to drop him for Wellington. I know he scored last week, Wellington, but he's more of a you lump him on at the end just to mix things up and he might try and win you something. You want your out-and-out best goal scorer on the pitch, and he wasn't. And Wellington missed a glorious opportunity at the end of the first half, which I am 100% confident Shuto Machino would have finished. So I think this was a missed opportunity for Shonan. I don't understand the decision to drop Machino, but at the end of the day, they'd probably take a point against Reds, and he keeps their head above water for now.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the stand-in coach, Kenji Takahashi, decided he wanted to put his stamp on things by shaking things up and resting Machino, benching Machino. I don't know how he spun it to the rest of the squad. But, yeah, a bit of a head-scratching decision, no question about that. And, well, yeah, Wellington, the big fella, he's you can't fault his effort. But, yeah, he's certainly better off the bench these days. And, yeah, hopefully that's how it'll be used for the remainder of Shonan's fixtures. And, well, Alan, we might as well move off this game because there wasn't a massive amount of talking points, I don't think, from it. But yeah, Shonan, another point. But yeah, as Sam says, they might have done better, and their performance might have deserved a couple more points. But they'll have to do with one. And we'll wrap up the dogfight with the team again. Musical chairs in the cellar and at the top of J1. Now we have musical chairs in 16th spot, which of course has to play a promotion relegation playoff against the playoff winners from J2. The current occupants of that position after match day 30 are Kyoto Sanga, after they headed to the National Stadium to face FC Tokyo. Tokyo winning 2-0 at the National Stadium for the second time this season. Maybe they should think about playing there a little bit more often. I don't know. One for the bean counters down in Chofu to consider, perhaps. Tokyo defeating Kansai rivals at Kokuritsu for the second time this season. And it was a pair of Brazilians who netted for them. Leandro with a terrific strike from the edge of the box just before the half hour. A rare shot that went in off two pieces of the woodwork, skimming the bar before hitting the keeper's left-hand post before settling into the net. And then Adailton finishing off the last 15 minutes after the Kyoto keeper, Naoto Kami Fukumoto, spilled a shot from Hirotaka Mita. So Tokyo winning for the first time in a while and moving up to seventh. But yes, from a Kansai perspective, Alan, a disappointing performance on a big stage from Kyoto. Their second straight defeat, as I said, leaves them down in 16th and with an awful lot to do in their remaining five games.
Indeed. I think they've had plenty of COVID problems as well as injuries this year, which have messed them about a bit. They haven't been able to field a settled lineup, and Pito Utaka, I think, started this one for the first time in, I don't know, five or six games, didn't do a lot, unfortunately. Toyokawa is actually coming into his own a little bit and scoring a goal now and then, and missing out on injuries, thankfully. But they don't really have any great players that help. I think Shunpei Fukuoka is probably one of the best they have, and he was on the bench. I like Kawasaki as well. Those are the kind of players I love, of course, because Kawasaki and Fukuoka are names of other football teams as well. But I digress. Hisashi Apiatawe has been missing. Ogiwara, the left back, who's probably also one of the stars for me, has gone, I think he came back for half a game recently. So manager Cho Kuijie has had his problems, and they looked quite good earlier in the season. I think after about 10 games they were in the top six or so, weren't they? And then they've just had a dire run where they've only won two games in 20 plus, or three games, of course, because they beat Vissel Kobe quite easily. This one was probably a huge disappointment in the end, because you know they really needed a win, and let's face it, Tokyo aren't that good at the moment.
Yeah, I'd argue, but I can't. Yeah, no, that's true. But thankfully, as I said, on the big stage in front of just under 51,000, Tokyo scored a couple of goals to send almost everybody home happy. And Sam, Alan's mentioned some of the numbers there for Kyoto. I mean, it's just one win in their last 10. since they took care of Sapporo in early July. And yes, that that only win came 4 games ago at home against Kobe. That was maybe the kick up the backside that Kobe needed, because since then they've obviously racked up a number of points and worked their way above Sanga in the table. But yeah, obviously you flagged it ages ago that you were worried about Sanga slipping down. I don't know, we've mentioned that Fukuoka have done that recently, and indeed Shonan have edged their way back towards the drop zone. But I guess it's once again, it's time to be worried about Sanga again, because they're in the hot seat.
Yeah, I think I'm always going to be a little bit worried about Sanga, because, yeah, as Adam says, the quality isn't really there, especially if Utaka's not firing on all cylinders. Yeah, they do struggle. I thought their performances last week against Kashima were very good. They were a little unfortunate not to win that game. In midweek, they gave Marinos a really good game as well, but I think those two performances, they just kind of ran themselves into the ground, and by the time they turned up at the National Stadium, I think they were running on fumes. And yeah, Tokyo took advantage, and you could see that from the Leandro goal. Terrific strike, but he's got so much space around him and no one closes him, and that wouldn't have happened in the previous two games, because they built good performances on just working really hard, closing down, pressing really quickly, and they just didn't have the energy to do that, and Tokyo took full advantage. Yeah, the break I think will do them a lot of good, but I think Kyoto's fixtures are quite difficult. I think it's only Jubilo that they play who are currently in the bottom half. Maybe Nagoya as well, who are on the edge, but generally it's quite difficult fixtures. So yeah, they're in a difficult position, but I do still believe that their manager is the best one to have in this situation at the bottom, and I do think they will fight and grind and do everything they can to survive. So yeah, it's a difficult situation, but yeah, just get back to the way they're playing previously, and the break should really help them do that.
Indeed, and yeah, their next two opponents are Tosu and Nagoya in 8th and 10th respectively, so in mid-table mediocrity with not a massive amount to play for in the remaining month or so of the season. So yeah, Kyoto will definitely be scrapping for their lives, no question about that. So we mentioned the big occasion and the big crowd at the National Stadium on Sunday night. To Alan, it was also notable for the fact that that game, FC Tokyo versus Kyoto, was officiated by a female referee. That's the first time that's ever happened in J1 history. Yoshimi Yamashita made a history at the National Stadium. I think that from the DAZN commentator, she'd refereed a total of 17 games in either J2 or J3 before making her J1 debut on Sunday night. From everything that I saw from the game, she did a terrific job, as everyone would have expected. That's why she was given that responsibility. And I guess we hope that in the months and years to come, mentioning a female referee doing a men's game, well, hopefully it won't be that noteworthy at all, because it'll just become commonplace. But someone has to be the first to do it, and it was Ms. Yamashita on Sunday night, and she was a credit to herself. So I think it's worthy of a mention, and yourself as a qualified referee, I'm sure you'd like to give her props as well.
Indeed, no complaints about her performance whatsoever. I think in football, as in the rest of the world, really, it shouldn't really matter. Oh, it's a lady, and hopefully there will be more ladies coming, or maybe there'll be a blind guy in a wheelchair, you know, whatever. I don't think it really matters who does it. It's, you know, the best person, the best man for the job, and the best person for the job. And she was fine, and hopefully there are many other female referees coming through the ranks that will join in. And as you say, it'll just be a normal thing; we won't even notice it.
Indeed, indeed. So, a grand occasion. And as a Tokyo supporter, I'm glad to see my team back to winning ways, and wishing Kyoto the best for the remainder of the dogfight. And yes, again, well done to Ms. Yamashita for her performance. All right. So, thanks again for running through the first 5 games of the match day with us, Alan, before you jet off on your jollies on Tuesday. We do very much appreciate you making the time to join us to chat about the Kobe Gumba game primarily. But we're also very excited to hear in the green room that after a long COVID-enforced break, that there might just be a new issue of J-Soccer magazine in the wings.
Yes, indeed. I don't want to take up too much time, but yes, COVID basically killed it off, because all the sponsors disappeared. Not that there were any in the last few years. And then postage is just a pain. I thought about going just PDF, just on the internet, on the web version. But, you know, you really need a piece of paper in your hand to, you know, wherever you happen to want to read it, or just display it or whatever. So a magazine is underway, and I just I just, instead of, you know, giving it the big sell now, I would say, please do mention it over the next few weeks. And if I let you know there's one there, I'll send you a copy, of course. Perhaps you can discuss it or have me on again. And I beg the support of all your listeners out there to perhaps buy a magazine or at least a PDF and help pay for it. Lots of Celtic in it. You know, that's probably predictable. But my photographer, Lionel Piguet, went to Celtic and they were very nice to him. And there's lots of great Celtic pictures. And also we've got some other interviews. John Mary of Avispa Fukuoka kindly sat down with me for 2 hours and talked about everything. And it's a very interesting interview. And I'd really like to put it out on jsoccer.com, I think, because it's very topical. And I wonder how long it might take me to get the magazine out there. But the John Mary interview is excellent. I've given it 4 pages in the magazine, so that's good. And so lots of Celtic, lots of John Mary, and it's sadly a bit late because I really wanted to do this, you know, 6-9 months ago. There's really a lot of interest, as usual, in the J League shirts this year. So 10 or 12 or 15 pages, depending on what I finish with, will be basically a J League shirt bible as well. And that's always a big interest, a big seller, or at least big on the internet. So thank you for the opportunity to mention it. And yeah, there's a magazine on the way. And you follow me on Twitter at JSoccer Magazine, or look at jsoccer.com for some details. Or please tweet me, email me, alan@jsoccer.com. And I do have a Patreon. It's very sparse at the moment because, as I say, we haven't done one for 2 years, so I haven't been pushing it. But there's a Patreon out there too, so look out for JSoccer Magazine. Perhaps you can join in the Patreon and add $1 or $2 a month and help us get along. Thank you very, very much for the opportunity, and thanks for having me on. The pleasure is all yours.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, yeah, really looking forward to that. And I know Sam especially will be, his eyes will have pricked up as soon as you mentioned the name John Mary. So I know you'll definitely be selling a copy to Sam.
Be giving one to Sam.
Well, that's very kind of you. But yeah, does he answer the question, why am I always sat on the bench?
He does, actually, yes. It's very interesting. He has a go at the management, and he has a go at one of the very interesting things he mentions about how to get chosen for Cameroon. And it involves giving certain people amounts of money. He doesn't hold his police punches. It's a very interesting interview. And he gives me warts and all. So that's why I say I want to get it out quicker. He's very good. So maybe I'll send you that one in advance, Sam, okay?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, but don't send it to Avispa supporters and anyone like that. Let's let them get through the season, I think, before dropping any sort of bombshells on them.
Well, I was going to say, Sam, maybe Alan should send a copy to the manager, Shigetoshi Hasebe, to remind him that he's got John Mary on his books, and maybe he should be playing him a little bit more. He obviously didn't even come on Saturday night. So, that's absolutely brilliant. And, yeah, great to hear after such a long break and, obviously COVID enforced that, JSoccer Magazine is swinging back into action. So, yes, follow Alan on his socials. Long-term listeners, I'm sure you've got Alan's email address still tattooed on your brain. I certainly could recite it in my sleep. So, get in touch with Alan. And, I'm sure everybody's looking forward to the issue of JSoccer Magazine that's coming soon. So, well, Alan's already said his goodbyes. So we will thank him again for his time on this week's episode. And after a quick hit of music, Sam and I will wrap up the last 4 games from the J1 Match Day 30 fixture list. Welcome back. 4 games left to review then, and they all ended in draws, Sam. We'll begin at Hitachi Dai on Saturday night, where Kawasaki visited Kashiwa at Frontale. Of course, the two-time defending champions were looking to get back to winning ways after a frustrating draw away at Nagoya in midweek. Kento Tachibanada had given them the lead against Grampus, but then unwittingly deflected Sho Inagaki's 25-yard volley past the keeper with 15 minutes to go. And Frontale unable to score again. So that was a frustrating draw for them in midweek. And it was more of the same at Hitachi Dai on Saturday night, Sam. And another 1-1 draw for Frontale. And we expected that was all the invitation that F Mariners would need to pretty much nail down the title on Sunday night. As we'll come to shortly, that wasn't to be the case. But yet another frustrating evening for Frontale, having taken the lead, but again, pegged back.
Yeah, a couple of really poor performances. They thought maybe there's some momentum after beating Hiroshima 4-0, but midweek they went down to Nagoya. Oniki was just prickly ahead of that game because he wasn't happy about the way that the original game had been postponed and the way that Nagoya handled that. And yeah, that he just seemed angry and annoyed, and they just didn't perform well. They took the lead, but as soon as Minagaki scored, there was no response from Kawasaki. And it was the same against Kashiwa. Again, decent enough, just take the lead. As soon as Kashiwa get back into it, there was no response at all. It was just so flat from Kawasaki. Very few chances. They had, I think Tomo had one right towards the end, a speculative effort from outside the area that was well saved. But yeah, really flat and poor from Kawasaki. And the neutral doesn't want this to happen, but they seem to be surrendering the title in fairly meek circumstances, at least from the last two games.
Yeah, and that that result on the Saturday night meant that they were 4 points behind F Marinos. So obviously a win at home for Yokohama F Marinos against Sapporo on Sunday night would have taken them 7 points clear, and they're already a large whack of goal difference ahead. So it basically would have almost needed them to start engraving F Marinos' name on the championship shield. But again, as I said right off the top of the episode, for the first time in living memory, the Sapporo defense stood up and stood tall and repelled the leaders. And Sam, I tell you what, I was expecting a tennis score in this game, and I tell you what, I reckon goodness me, like 7-5 is more believable to me at kickoff than 0-0, considering these two teams. And obviously the way they go about things, and the fact that it's ended scoreless is frankly beggared belief. And but again, fans of the title race can breathe again. Obviously it's a 5-point gap now, and F Marinos, one game less to play each with Frontale. They both have 5 games left, so it would take a monumental implosion for F Marinos to not win it from here. But it was there for them to do. They were unable to do so, and we have to give Sapporo their credit for playing their part in this game, and to their defense for holding strong against the leaders.
Yeah, it was completely unbelievable. I don't think I'd have ever believed that a team that moved Daiki Suga to centre-back was going to keep a clean sheet against Marinos, but they managed to do just that. They defended pretty well, but a few times bailed out by Sugano, who had a fantastic game in goal. Marinos was slightly the better team, I thought, but Sapporo, decent on the counter-attack. They had a few chances themselves. Takeoka played well, so yeah, goalkeepers on top, so it was a weird scoreline. Yeah, I never expected 0-0. Like, there were a few changes for Marinos. They had to change Eduardo out, and Sonoda came in. First start he'd had in a little while. He looked very accomplished, and I have to get this in. Scott McIntyre made 2 requests to me for this episode. One was an hour in length, and one was to have a love-in for Sonoda. So unfortunately, we're over that hour, and because of that, we probably can't have the love-in for Sonoda either, but he did play very well, so I've got that in for him. But yeah, generally, defences and goalkeepers on top here. And yeah, very surprising scoreline. And I think this just kind of happens, doesn't it? When teams get into a chance to win the league, they have to drop points. That just seems to be the mentality of any team in the J-League.
Well, yeah, it just goes to add on to the burgeoning legend of this league. Yeah, you just cannot predict anything from week to week. Again, as I said, I would have believed 10-10 rather than 0-0, a more likely scoreline between these two teams. But that's how it went. And in the post game interview, I think Kevin Muscat said it was F Marinos' 5th game in 15 or 16 days. So you can understand the players being slightly worn down. He would have loved obviously one last push before the international break, but as it was, they've held serve after Frontale's draw on Saturday. So that would suit F Marinos down to the ground for the remainder of the season. Of course, they've got that buffer. It's and with the extra goal difference, it basically counts for an extra point. So it's definitely, it goes without saying, it's in F Marinos' hands with the 5 games left for both of the top two. And we'll wait and see if there's any twists in the tail in the last month or so of the season. Third place to Hiroshima were also only able to settle for a point over the weekend. They travelled to Nagoya. Grampus at home for the second straight game. Of course, as we mentioned, they drew with Frontale in midweek, and they held the third place team to a 0-0 draw here. Sam, I'm not sure if there's a massive amount we can take away from this game. It was, yeah, it looked fairly evenly balanced from the highlights. Chances at either end, but at the end of the day, yeah, both goalkeepers in decent enough form. Keisuke Osako making some excellent saves for Hiroshima. On another day, Nagoya might have won it at home, but yeah, ultimately both teams having to settle for a point.
Yeah, I think Osako especially was very good in this game. One of the saves, I think it was, he saved one from Nagai, I think it was, where he tipped it over, and there was another one from Nagaki, and a double save as well. I think he denied Nagai, then Morishita. So I thought he played fantastically. He obviously didn't make the national team squad, but he's definitely putting himself there. Goes, look, I'm still here. I could be of use. So I thought that was a good performance from him. But otherwise, this was a very dull game. You know, like when teams get into mid-table, you kind of hope that at the end of the season they just open up and it's really exciting games. But Nagoya are not deciding to give any neutrals any excitement as they tail their season off. So, yeah, it was 90 minutes, and that's about all I can say on the game.
Indeed. So, overall, at the end of the weekend, Hiroshima happy enough with the draw, I suppose, although they could have opened up some more breathing room ahead of Cerezo, who, of course, dropped those 2 points after taking the lead away at bottom club Iwata. And so to the final game of the match day to review, it was actually the first one played last Friday night down at the real estate agent in front of the station stadium. Tosu hosted Kashima, and I guess, Sam, this almost qualifies as a mid-table battle now, because the Antlers have well and truly slipped off the pace that the top three have set. And, well, yes, they're obviously still a chance to qualify for the ACL directly through winning the Emperor's Cup, but it doesn't look like they're going to do it through their league placing after, yes, another frustrating evening for them, a 1-1 draw away at Tosu. And I don't know. I think Antlers just can't wait for this season to end, can they?
No, I don't know. Like I've said it many times, I don't know what's gone on with them, but something is not right. They ended this game with Daikiwa Masa berating the referee, and Yuma Suzuki, I think, boots off in his socks just having a go at the linesman. And yeah, it's clear there's a bit of discontent at that team. They're not playing very well. Tosu, I thought, were the better side in this game. I thought Miyashiro's goal, I think, is the one takeaway from this. The touch control, movement away from the defender, and the finish was absolutely fantastic. But yeah, and Kashima got their goal back. I don't think it was particularly deserved, and the game kind of petered out a little bit after that. But yeah, they're long away from the Kashima team, kind of the swashbuckling Kashima team of the start of the season. And yeah, Tosu just keep going on. They're doing pretty well in eighth.
Indeed. And so that's the match they wrapped up in full then. As we said, a number of draws. But yeah, those two huge six-pointers down in the dogfight, they provided certainly a number of talking points for us at the beginning of the episode. Of course, the league now pauses for the international break, but we do have the two Levain Cup semi-finals that will be played over the course of the international break on Wednesday the 21st. Cerezo Osaka host Urawa, and Fukuoka entertain Hiroshima in the first legs, with the reverse fixtures on Sunday the 25th. So we'll have a review of all of those games later on once they're concluded. But of course, yes, we mentioned it in passing a couple of times. The Japan national team will be in action in two friendlies in Dusseldorf in Germany. The first is against the USA this Friday, the 23rd, and the second is against Ecuador on Tuesday, the 27th. Last week, Mr. Moriyasu named an extended squad. Sam, any key takeaways from there? Any players you thought were unlucky to miss out, or some surprise selections, some players that you're looking forward to seeing that might be able to stake a last-minute claim for a spot in Mr. Moriyasu's World Cup squad?
Yeah, I think my biggest takeaway is the big issue at centre-back with Akoi Takura out injured. He's facing a real race against time to be fit for the World Cup. I think that leaves the centre-back options quite limited, especially as Tomiyasu's not really playing for Arsenal. We saw what Yoshida was like in the last internationals, and Ito's very inexperienced at this level. So they brought in Ayumu Seko, who I've always liked at Cerezo Osaka. He's playing fairly regularly for Grasshopper, so it'd be interesting to see if he can take his opportunity. I have the usual issues in goal, like Eiji Kawashima, but I just find with Moriyasu's squad, I'm just going to go, whatever, that's how it is going to be. I'm not going to bother wasting my breath arguing with that. But otherwise, there's still a lot of talent in that squad. It's like, not with the 30 players, you can get a lot of interesting players in there. I'd like to see a bit more from Daichi Kamada, because obviously his performances for Frankfurt have been very good, but doesn't always get the opportunity for Japan. Rare Hatate is back in. I thought he's played quite well for Celtic, and that first half performance against Real Madrid a few weeks ago was very nice. So hopefully we get to see a bit more of him. And Shuto Machino as well, who's the one who's really benefited from that East Asian Cup. He's managed to force his way in there, especially if Osako doesn't quite get fit enough. Maybe he is the closest striker to that sort of profile, and that might see him get into the squad for the World Cup. So yeah, there a lot of players have got interesting a couple of weeks ahead of them to see if they can press their claims. But yeah, anything you took away from that?
Well, yeah, I think Machino's the really interesting one, isn't he? It's certainly, if you had mentioned his name at the start of the season, you would have been laughed out of the room. But yeah, he's done terrifically well for Shonan this season, and yeah, obviously in the EAFF as well. So yeah, I'm fully expecting that Osako will, even an 80% Yuya Osako will make it into the final squad. But yeah, Machino has a chance to, I suppose, stake his claim for a spot as one of the reserves, because I'm not sure whether he would, if Osako does make it, then I'm not sure he'll take a like for like in the squad as well, because with so many other attacking players at his disposal. But yeah, it's definitely an opportunity for Machino, and again another chance for Ito, the defender, not Junior Ito, of course. We know he's going to be there for Mr. Moriyasu, but he obviously he had his moments in his first couple of appearances for Japan, but whether he can properly stake his claim for a spot in the World Cup squad, I think is definitely one to watch. As you say, Itakura's injury couldn't have come at a worse time. So we'll wait and see how Japan fare in these two games. A number of players with obviously a case to make, and spots to lock up in the World Cup squad. So they will be fascinating games to watch, I'm sure. And we'll be looking forward to reviewing them in next week's episode. So Sam, yeah, enjoy the break from no J1. Of course, no rest for the wicked. You still have to put up with the Louvain semi-finals, of course. But yes, the internationals should be interesting as well. So yeah, look forward to wrapping up as much of it's been played as by the time we reconvene next week to chat about it.
Sounds good. Yeah, I don't mind the Louvain Cup when it gets to the semi-final stage, so I can enjoy that. I can look at some J2 this weekend, which I don't usually get to do. So, yeah, it's an interesting week for me regardless. And, yeah, looking forward to wrapping it all up with you next week. Hopefully Japan have put in at least one or maybe two positive performances by the time we next speak, and we can look ahead to the World Cup with a bit more hope than I currently have. So, yeah, see you. Yeah, speak to you next week.
All right, yes, fingers crossed, and yes, we can but hope. All right, then, so that's it for this week's episode of the J-Talk Podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Alan Gibson once again very much for his time in part one of this week's episode. I hope he has a great time over in Thailand. Thanks to all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. And listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.